This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Copley, my colleague. He's the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. The theme is alliances, PACs, ones that are pertinent and immediate because of a need, because the values are shared to defend one or a group of states, and PACs that are out of date, alliances out of date, are no longer effective. We go to the Indo-Pacific. The Bali meeting for the G20 has evidenced that there are players here that are anxious about each other and their commitments. Gregory, you identified the Quad as something that was created in the first decade of this century, rejuvenated in the second decade of this century, and now today, where is it in the third decade?
It's in very parlous state. What we saw with the Quad, which is the more or less semi-formal alliance of India, Japan, Australia, and the United States, meant to contain the People's Republic of China, suffered an enormous blow when the United States withdrew from Afghanistan in the manner that it did in August of last year. That shocked the Indian government to its core. It felt that the United States was not a capable power, was not a reliable ally, and therefore caused New Delhi to start rethinking how it would approach its own existential competition with the People's Republic of China. On May 24th, the big Quad summit in Tokyo, Australia's prime minister, who'd been sworn in less than a day before, was there. He was very inexperienced. The Indian prime minister was there and so on. And Joe Biden was there, urging the three other Quad members to sign a document which would condemn Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. India said, basically, this is not what we're here for. We're here to contain and deal with the People's Republic of China, and refused to be a party to that statement, which, of course, never came out. But it showed India that the United States had been prepared to go soft on Beijing and continue its push into the Euro-Atlantic sphere with the war in Russia through Ukraine. So, again, Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India was really accelerating his disbelief in the U.S. future. And then we had on September the 15th and 16th this year, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, which was held in Samarkand in Uzbekistan. And Narendra Modi was there. He's a member of the SCO as well, because of India's interest in of course, what goes on its own continent. And he had a meeting with Xi Jinping where he agreed that he would scale back the tensions with China over the occupation and border on the Tibetan plateau. This was a huge relief to Xi Jinping, who could now know that his flank was not going to be vulnerable at a time when he would escalate tensions against and possibly war against Taiwan, the Republic of China. So in that sense, the Quad was severely weakened through this process. India is no longer being seen as a major ally in the war against China, nor against the Russian Federation. In fact, India has been explicit in that it needs to continue its defense supply relationship with Russia, and it has expanded its energy supply relationship with Russia. So the Quad itself has suffered enormously and is no longer seen as safe. And if that was not a betrayal along the lines, by the way, of the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact itself, where the players are looking to preserve security on their flanks while they're about their business, we then see President Biden going to the Bali summit of G20 and appeared to be going to Xi Jinping, the new victor in the Chinese political realm. That was very bad optics. I know that's not what Biden intended, but it looked as though Biden was going to Xi, and certainly Biden did say that he was working on approaches with Xi Jinping to diminish tensions between the PRC and the United States. And that's going back to the 1939 parallels. That smacks of Neville Chamberlain's statement, peace in our time. All it was doing was giving Xi Jinping time to consolidate his power after he won the third term as General Secretary of the Communist Party of China. So essentially, we are not doing well in those departments. There are other actions which were very significant in this period. We've got the United Kingdom coming out in support under the new Prime Minister, supporting the defense of Taiwan. We've got the UK and Japan getting ready to sign a major defense treaty next month, which will also include the cooperation on the development of a new fighter, sixth generation fighter aircraft. We had the Australians in January this year sign a similar strategic relationship with Japan, and we're looking at the Philippines signing such a relationship with Japan. Also, at the Bali summit, we saw the Canadian Premier, Justin Trudeau, in a confrontation with Xi Jinping for releasing details of their discussion earlier in the summit. And that put Justin Trudeau on the defensive. So it's possible that Justin Trudeau, who I don't think will be in office 6 months from now, nonetheless is rethinking how friendly he is and with Beijing, and how friendly Beijing is toward him. He thought he had a special relationship with Xi Jinping. That's not the case, as was demonstrated at the Bali summit.
There is a new pact in the Indo-Pacific, this vast canvas of water involving Oceania, the small republics that China targets for acquisition in order to break the first island chain that contains the Chinese ambitions. But the new pact is called AUKUS, Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Is that effective, Gregory? Because those three states do share values.
They do, and they share intelligence, and they share a common defense operating framework. So it's incredibly significant. They are already more integrated and more efficient as a global fighting force than NATO ever was. And this is truly a global alliance. Because of the nature of the three participants in AUKUS, they have access to the North and South Atlantic, the Mediterranean, the entire Pacific, and the Indian Ocean, and the Mediterranean, as I said. So and the polar region. So they have a unique defense capability. They have common, as you say, common ideals, and they have a much larger economy than anything else in the world today. And they are now working at a professional level, that is through the defense ministries, on the containment of the People's Republic of China. And this is becoming very evident. It was evident by the British Prime Minister's statements before the G20 summit as well. What we are seeing is that the Australian Prime Minister and the British Prime Minister are well committed to this alliance. And the U.S. Defense and State Department structures are committed to this alliance. We have yet to see President Biden show any interest in or knowledge of the AUKUS treaty. He's been more concerned about diverting attention to the Euro-Atlantic threat, namely the Ukraine crisis.
And the threats to Taiwan are routine now. I note that Wang Yi, the foreign minister, talked about red lines and being very aggressive in his language about how the U.S. Must back off from its interests with its ally, Taiwan. Does that challenge the AUKUS alliance in some fashion? And does that challenge all of the neighborhood, including Japan?
It does indeed. And certainly the Japanese prime minister has indicated that he will soon be speaking to Xi Jinping about methods of reducing bilateral tensions there. But the Japanese are under no illusion that they need, they need to calm down the threat of immediate conflict with the PRC, merely to give Japan even more time to improve its self-defense forces, which are becoming quite potent and significant in terms of not only their efficiency, but also their reach. They're getting longer range aircraft and capabilities. The fact is that we're seeing these network of alliances, the these regional security arrangements between Japan and the US, Japan and Australia, Japan and the UK, and so on, compensating along with AUKUS for the decline of the Quad. And it's unfortunate because the great strength of the Quad was that it could really distract China on its southern flanks with India in the event that a war began over Taiwan. Now, the reality is that Xi Jinping himself has got so many problems on his plate domestically that he will either do one of two things. One, he will attempt to delay and soften the necessity for immediate action on Taiwan, or he will escalate against Taiwan in order to distract the restive domestic population from its problems.
Gregory, you've talked about bilateral relationships between the U.S. and members of the of East Asia, Japan, for example. Is a NATO for East Asia in line? Is that useful?
Well, I think the analogy with NATO is actually unfortunate and outdated. What we have to understand is that the way in which the NATO alliance was built to some degree, the way AUKUS is still structured is that these are seen as security and military pacts predominantly involving the armed forces of the countries. The reality is that there is a new form of warfare being conducted, the new total war operating scenario, which the Chinese are following in great detail. They call it unrestricted warfare, but it's a development, an evolution of the total war concepts, which began in the Napoleonic era, really, and escalated through the 20th century, under which the objective is to win the war by means other than military confrontation. Once you get a kinetic military operation underway, the outcome becomes uncertain, as Japan found out when it attacked at Pearl Harbor on December the 7th, 1941. You don't want to go into a military conflict unless you absolutely have to, or unless you have actually already won the war, and that the military phase is just, if you like, the symbolic mopping up or destruction of your adversary. So China is fighting a war which is on every other front than military confrontation. The role of the People's Liberation Army is key to this, because military forces need to be used for prestige, for intimidation, for power projection. But once you use them, and once you start to use them, you're committed down a path which could be very uncertain. So China knows how it's fighting the war, and the West thinks that it's waiting for some kind of, you know, military accident, two ships colliding at sea or firing on each other or something. The reality is that the war is already underway, and the West keeps thinking that we're waiting for the militaries to attack each other, and that's futile. This is the way you lose a world, in waiting for a war.
And Gregory, quickly, you write that the war on terror was a tactical war and it diverted the U.S. from a larger picture. Is the conflict in East Asia, is that a strategic war?
Absolutely, it's a strategic war, because we're seeing now the transformation of the global architecture. We're not seeing the clear lines we saw during the Cold War between, if you like, freedom and oppression. We're seeing a very muddied picture on both sides as to who's free and who's oppressed. I think what will emerge, particularly under Xi Jinping in the People's Republic of China, is that China will once again show its colors as a Maoist oppressive state, and will kill many of its own citizens in the process, as Mao did particularly in the 1956 to 61 Great Leap Forward. But the reality is the West is still not re-emerging as a cohesive cultural and ethical and an idealistic set of values, and that's really what's challenging the West. We have become incredibly materialistic and transactional, and that's hardly enough to inspire a great difference between light and dark in terms of looking at the power balances between the great strategic blocks.
Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, and a colonial, as I am. Gregory's a national, a member of the national population of Australia. I'm a member of the national population of the United States. And once upon a time, we had a king. And we do again. So when we come back, the King Charles Report. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.